Legal Face-Off on WGNRadio.com is brought to you by McCorkle Litigation Services, leaders in court reporting and legal technology.
Hey, what's up, y'all? It's your man Montel Jordan, and this is how we do it. And right now, you're listening to Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. That's right, you're locked onto the high-energy legal podcast with lawyers Rich Lenkov and Tina Martini, and they're going to be trading jabs on the breaking news and the hottest issues, sports, entertainment, politics. Nothing is off limits. Keep listening, because this is how we do it.
Welcome to another edition of Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. Of course, we have Tina Martini, McDermott, Willa, and Schulte, and Rich Lenkov from Downey & Lenkov. I'm your moderator, Ryan Burrow. The Department of Justice has until Friday, December 19th, to release the Epstein files. Who better to talk with us about that than Gloria Allred, who represents 27 Jeffrey Epstein survivors. She's founding partner of Allred Morocco and Goldberg, where she's been fighting for victims' rights for four decades with a major focus on women's rights cases. And of course, she's a repeat guest on Legal Face-Off. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me. And by the way, I have to update the resume because it's now 5 decades, 50 years fighting for women's rights and minority rights, gay and lesbian rights and racial minorities. So anyway, thank you very much for inviting me to join you, especially on this very important topic of the Epstein survivors and victims.
Laura, you are one of the true legends in our industry, so we're really privileged and humbled to have you on. And as a repeat guest, we're really fortunate to have you on this. As you mentioned, important day. Tomorrow is the release of the Epstein files. You've represented many of the victims. Let's talk about how this release affects them emotionally. It's got to be very traumatic, again, to relive all this, but also tempered by a feeling of happiness that their stories are finally being told.
Well, it was a battle that was waged by many survivors to get the bill passed, which would require that the Department of Justice release their investigative and prosecutorial files on Jeffrey Epstein. Why there was such resistance by the administration, we may find out when we see the actual release of the Epstein files. But they had to, the survivors, speak out. Many gathered in D.C. I was in D.C. at one of the rallies. And, you know, they fought the good fight. And they had righteousness on their side. And what was interesting, too, is that in every poll, both Democrats and Republicans, and then also independents, all indicated, the public indicated, they wanted the release of the Epstein files. You know, why? They wondered, is there a cover-up? What is being hidden? Why can't they be released? In any event, finally, there was a discharge petition that got enough signatures in the House of Representatives. So the House passed it, then the Senate passed it. And despite the fact that the president said it was a hoax, he did sign it into law. So tomorrow is the day of the release. And then comes the question, what can we expect tomorrow? By the way, there were a few new photos also just released this morning by Democrats who are a minority, of course, on the House committees. But a few photographs were released, but there's no context for them. And in any event, tomorrow we'll see what is released. What should we expect? Should we expect the release of all the files? I say no. Lower our expectations, because my guess is, just a guess, that the Department of Justice will say, well, we're still investigating certain people involved with Epstein, and until we decide if we're going to prosecute or not, those files will not be released. So we'll have to see. They won't say who they're investigating. Of course, the president said investigate the Democrats. He was a Democrat once, but no longer. So I don't think he means himself. But having said that, we'll have to see what is released. The main point is this: what the purpose of the Epstein files release is that the public and survivors want to see, are there any third parties, rich, powerful, famous men, for example, who should have been investigated, have been investigated, and should they be prosecuted? Is there evidence beyond a reasonable doubt? If they weren't prosecuted, why not? Now you may say, well, don't they have confidence in the Department of Justice to prosecute anyone if there's evidence sufficient to prosecute them? The answer is no. The survivors have been failed year after year since 2008, when there was a sweetheart deal for Jeffrey Epstein, where he only had to serve 13 months in jail for soliciting an act of prostitution with a minor. And during the day, he was allowed to go to his office where allegedly he sexually abused women while he was in his office, and then returned to jail at night to sleep. So again, he died in custody, whether it was suicide or homicide, in 2019, after he was arrested on federal charges. What happened there? That's a subject for another time. Was it suicide or homicide? Bottom line is, survivors didn't get to confront him in a court of law as they wanted to. So let's try to get truth, transparency, and justice at this point.
Gloria, let's pick it up there, because you've said a lot. What options are there, if any, if the release of these files leads to the conclusion, or at least the suspicion, that there are others involved? Are there still criminal options available, given statute of limitations, number one, and are there any civil options still available?
Well, Rich, you did ask a key question right there. Are there any civil options available? I guess it does depend on, for civilly, meaning to seek compensation in the civil justice system, if a harm has been inflicted on, you know, a woman or a man, if they're survivors of Epstein or Maxwell. You're right, statute of limitations, which is the arbitrary time period set by law, different in every state, may have expired. We have been able to win compensation for many survivors through the Jeffrey Epstein Estate Compensation Fund. But, you know, there's still banks, for example, that may end up getting sued. So we may end up representing survivors in banks if they assisted, enabled, conspired with Jeffrey Epstein to sex traffic underage girls or adults. But let's see, you know, each survivor, Rich, does know her own truth. She knows what happened to her. What she wants to know is the big picture. What happened, you know, what was the scheme? Who enabled and assisted and conspired with Epstein for him to be able to do what he did? And so we'll have to see. I don't know if they're going to be civil options, and I don't know if there will be enough evidence to prosecute these third parties, these rich, powerful, famous men, by the Department of Justice. And even if there is sufficient evidence, will they be prosecuted? So we just have to wait and see. But we're just
on Legal Face-Off.
Gloria, as we know, as we've mentioned, you have been a pioneer and a leader in the civil rights movement now for, as you said, your entire 50-year
50
career.
Years.
And
yep.
In particular for gender rights, right? So what does it say about where we are as an American society when still in 2025, almost 2026, on the verge of 2026, these women are still being shamed frequently? They have to go through all of these battles when they are coming forward. And these are allegations against really, you know, overwhelmingly white, powerful, wealthy men.
Well, I always say to women and to minorities, no one has ever given you your rights. No one will ever give you your rights. You always have to fight to win it. We had to fight for many, many years, from 1848 to 1920, just to win the right to vote for women in the United States, the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. It's been now over 100 years that we've been fighting to add the Equal Rights Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. And we will have to be ever vigilant with the release of these files to see that whatever justice is possible is done. And so there is more ahead. Not every survivor is speaking out. Many of my clients, they just want privacy. And so far, we've been able to win that for them. Their names have not been revealed. And their name, and by the way, there is you know, a requirement that victims' names be redacted, any identifying information. about them be redacted from the release of the files. So I hope that continues, but it will take courage to continue. But I am satisfied that there are so many women who will be willing to demonstrate their courage to win more justice than they've won so far. And I'm very proud to represent some of them.
Gloria, last question on a different track entirely, maybe around the holidays. You could give some advice to some of our, you know, up-and-coming attorneys, many of whom watch and follow our show. I mean, are you entering your 86 years? At 87, my math is a little off, but you're well into your 80s. And you are still doing this every day, and not just doing it, you're doing it in a way that is just incredibly impressive. You're full of energy, you work hard, you actually handle everyday cases as well. I know you're incredibly successful. You do a lot of media, you're much in demand. How do you do it? How do you wake up every morning? What's your motivation to get up, get out of bed, and do what you do?
Well, I am 84 years old.
Thank God. I overshot it. I'm so sorry.
I don't care. I think we should get a medal as women for surviving through the things that all of us as women have to survive. So 84, I wake up every morning, Rich, and I say, what? And it just gets me going. I don't need coffee. So I always say fighting injustice is very good for the health. So I fight it every day, and every day there's more injustice. But the good news is that women are standing up and fighting back. Gay and lesbian transgender people are fighting back against discrimination. Racial minorities are fighting back. And so through this process of representing them, not only to win compensation for them, but also, you know, to help them to become empowered, this is just a beautiful thing. It inspires me every day. So I'm going to go for as long as life gives me, long as God gives me life, I'm going to go. And if I can find a way to do it thereafter, I will. I'm very happy, blessed to be able to represent my clients and get them through their journey to justice. And I might add, I just got a wonderful Christmas present because my first great grandson, Jack, was just born. And so I think he's going to be, my daughter is an attorney, my granddaughter, grandson are attorneys. And of course, we're just waiting for Jack to become a feminist attorney as well.
So Lisa Bloom, she's been on our show as well.
There you go. All right. So let's keep up the fight and let's keep listening to your show, because I think it's very important for people to know that there are people just like them that are continuing to fight for justice. So we build this house of justice brick by brick, and each person contributes to it. And there is nothing that any elected official can say. And I think you can imagine who I'm talking about, or many of the others, you know, that will stop us, because we know we have rights and we're going to assert those rights and we're going to vindicate those rights in courts of law, or often through many, many confidential settlements that we do without a lawsuit. So we're proud of our clients and their courage, and we will continue to fight the good fight.
She's been doing it for 5 decades now, Gloria Allred. Right. Thank you so much for joining us on Legal Face Off.
Thank you. Everybody have a happy holiday. Just remember, Santa Claus is really a woman. You know why? Who else would give so much and get so little in return?
Rich Lenkoff is an attorney with Downey & Lenkoff, a firm with offices in Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin. Rich is consistently recognized by clients like McDonald's, Target, Macy's, Wendy's, and the Chicago Bears for his zealous advocacy and outstanding litigation results. Rich's many accolades include being named as an Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 to present and leading lawyer from 2012 to present. These are designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, serving on the Legal Prep Charter Academy Advisory Board and the Northern Illinois University College of Law Board of Visitors. Rich is also a producer with credits including 85, The Greatest Team in Football History, starring Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka. Renegades, a Caesar's Palace production starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon, Rock of Ages, and Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel in concert. In addition to hosting WGN's Legal Face-Off since 2014, Rich serves as a legal analyst for a variety of media outlets. Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional malpractice, and intellectual property, among other practice areas. For more information about Rich and Downey & Lenkoff, please visit dl-firm.com.
Well, we've been keeping our eye on all the news related to the murder of Rob Reiner and his wife, Michelle, allegedly at the hands of their son, Nick, who has a history of substance abuse and mental health issues. It sounds like the murder charges could make Nick ineligible for inheritance in California. Sean Weisbart is a partner in trust and estates at Blank Rome in New York and here to talk with us about the Slayer statute. Sean, thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Ryan.
So there was a state law in California, Sean, tell us about that, that might make him ineligible to partake in the estate. What does that mean?
California has a state law, what we commonly refer to as the Slayer statute, that says if you murder someone, you become ineligible to inherit from the person you killed.
That seems like it should be the law in any state. Explain to us more why California has this particular law that prevents someone who kills their parents from also inheriting money from his parents. That seems like, I'm a lawyer too, but that seems like common sense.
Rich, it is common sense. And indeed, most states have the identical law that California has. Well, it's sort of stating the obvious, right? If you kill someone, you should absolutely not be able to inherit from that person. And from a policy perspective, right, you know, the law wants to ensure that someone's not going to commit a murder with the idea that they might benefit from it.
So, both a will and a revocable trust is very common when estate planning in California. Explain to us how that plays into the Slayer statute, if at all.
So the Slayer statute would apply both to a will and a revocable trust. But as you point out, Rich, quite common in California to have both. Effectively, what happens is when you die, the will says, put any asset that I have in my own name into my revocable trust. And then that revocable trust disposes of the assets. A lot of individuals will also fund that revocable trust while they're alive. And if you do so, you avoid probate, having to go to court and time delays, et cetera, right, on the probate and estate administration process. And that's why a lot of people will fund that revocable trust while they're alive. But in the case of Nick Reiner, if he's convicted of this crime, he is not going to inherit under either the will or revocable trust of his parents.
So presumably his shares would go to his surviving brother and sister, right, who released a statement obviously yesterday at how devastated they are over the loss of their parents, and they call them their best friends. Presumably their share would go to them. Is that correct?
I would presume that as well. I haven't seen the estate planning documents, but presumably the estate plan would say that all the children inherit equally. So Nick would be out. There are two children of the marriage, but Rob had a child that he adopted from his first marriage. So I don't know whether that child is treated equally as the other two children from the marriage, but no, stop. Going two or three ways.
Sorry to interrupt. What's very interesting is the statute doesn't require a conviction, right? So we know he's been charged. His attorney, Alan Jackson, who's a very high profile attorney, very expensive attorney, we'll deal with that later in the show, came out and said that, you know, obviously there's more to the story. His perspective is that there's lots of intricate legal issues involved. It will probably take a while to get a conviction if the prosecution is successful. What happens? Could he potentially inherit and then have the money taken away? You don't need a conviction, though. Tell us about that.
So you don't need a conviction. You're absolutely correct. The statute just requires that it be demonstrated that you committed the killing intentionally and what they call feloniously. And that does not require a criminal conviction. The Slayer statute is actually a civil statute. And under civil statutes, generally, it has to just be proven that it's more likely than not what the law calls a preponderance of the evidence, not the beyond a reasonable doubt standard that criminal courts apply, that this murder occurred. And so what I think would happen, right, I'm not involved in the case, would be the court would look at this issue and probably hold his inheritance, right, until the criminal matter is resolved, because if he's convicted, that's going to per se disqualify him from inheriting. But even without a conviction, it's possible the Slayer statute could preclude him from receiving an inheritance.
So when you say those words, a lot of our listeners and viewers will automatically think of another high-profile California case, one that also involved a murder in Brentwood, right, the O.J. Simpson killings, where he was ultimately found not guilty by a criminal jury. We understand that's a different standard than the one you just articulated. The civil standard is more probable than not, in which O.J. Simpson was convicted civilly or found guilty or liable civilly in that. That's similar standard that's going on here, yes?
Absolutely. That's completely correct.
So, Sean, I mentioned Alan Jackson, very expensive attorney, you know, represented, you know, some very high profile celebrities over the years. He was just retained and made an appearance yesterday in court for Nick Reiner. How do we think? I mean, obviously you're not involved. We don't know. But, you know, presumably he has access to his income right now. But presumably that'll go away. I wonder how he's going to pay for this very expensive defense.
It's a great question. Well, we read that Rob and Michelle were worth $200 million when they died. So it's possible that monies were already given to Nick during their life. And if he has access to those funds, meaning there were gifts made to him or income that he earned or assets that were transferred to him, he'll still have that to pay his legal fees. But he's not going to be able to use his inheritance if he's convicted or otherwise found to have intentionally committed this crime.
Sean, last question. We'll let you go. We appreciate your time. You know, we've also covered over the almost 11 years we've been doing this podcast, various examples of people who go to jail for crimes, including murder, and then write books. And there's always a, you know, discussion of the statute involved in whether you can profit from a crime that you were involved in. We know that O.J. Simpson, speaking of O.J., right, wrote a couple books. What's the law in California if Nick Reiner is convicted of murder and then decides to write a book in jail about, you know, this whole episode?
Yeah, I don't know the answer as to what would happen to any future profits from his crime under California law, but I would imagine there may also be civil actions that he may owe big penalties, and that any profits he might receive might have to go to pay that off. But it's a great question.
Sean Weisbart is with Blank Rome. Thank you so much for joining us on Legal Face Off.
Thank you guys for having me.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off with Rich Lenkoff and Tina Martini. I'm Ryan Burrow. Well, there's been a years-long battle over Tucker, the golden doodle who got caught between a breakup of a Delaware couple. David Favor is professor of law and the Nancy Heathcote professor of property and animal law at Michigan State University. He's here to talk with us about it. Professor Favor, thanks so much for coming on.
My pleasure.
Professor, in the short version of the story, there's a dog named Tucker, golden doodle, beautiful little dog, if you see the pictures. And there was a couple who lived together for a while. They bought the dog together, and then they broke up. And then the case made its way to, of all places, the Delaware Court of Chancery, which is usually the place where some of the biggest companies in the world work out their differences, right? And the court ended up awarding the dog to one party. But what was unusual is the judge said that ultimate ownership of the dog is going to be subject to an auction, rather than looking at, you know, this dispute in more traditional ways. What did you think of how the judge ended up deciding that part of it?
I was very sad. I think that that's truly going down the wrong road. That suggests the judge thinks that the dog represents money. It only has value as its value is the only thing that the court's going to recognize. And they're the person that values it the most, i.e. willing to pay the most, is the one that should have the dog. And that is running counter to all of the new laws that that we talk about now when it comes to divorce proceedings and companion animals. There's been six states, and I just saw Pennsylvania's House just passed one too, in where the judge, when there's a confrontation between two parties and one animal or more in between them, has the obligation to look at what's in the best interest of the animal. It doesn't matter who bought the animal. The question is, who would the animal be best with? Who should they live with? Who will most enhance the value of the life of the animal? And that's a very different question than who wants the animal the most, who bought the animal, a whole bunch of other things. It's close to what you would ask if you had a child. What's in the best interest of the child?
So, Professor, why do you think the court took this position, given what you've just profiled as the current state of the law? And I think that your analogy to looking at what other living sentient beings, if you will, including children, how the best interests of the child are looked at in circumstances like this.
I really don't know, because I have never heard of this in any proceeding that had an animal involved. So she probably thought, well, I don't want to make the decision. Therefore, I'm going to let you make the decision by putting dollars on the table. And that's sort of an abdication of a judge's responsibility. So, I'm very unhappy with what approach she took here. One caveat, I don't know the divorce law of the state that well as to how much flexibility the present law provides the judge.
Professor, there is a trend, as you mentioned, which is, in my opinion, a good thing, to move away from this idea that pets, dogs are just property, and moving more towards an analysis, understanding that, you know, these are members of the family. Right. And, you know, we covered just a few weeks ago the case in New York where, you know, the court actually allowed for recovery of pain and suffering when there was a, you know, surviving member of the dog's family who witnessed the dog die. That seems to be the trend, you know, in many states, but this unfortunately runs counter to that. You know, talk to us about why there is, at least seemingly in some states, this awareness that dogs are more than just, you know, like a car or, you know, a pair of shoes.
Right. Well, it's because they have political power. The idea of when you go talk to a state representative or senator, you can talk about your companion animals. Our society has risen that discussion about what are these animals that live with us to a much higher level than many other places in the world where you would not do that. But we now have, as a society, moved them up closer to children because of the emotional bonds that they present to us and the benefits they provide to us. We understand that to say that your dog is part of your family, particularly in a world where there are many, many couples with no children, it's a reality. And why should they be deprived of that emotional benefit of having a companion animal that lives with them?
So, Professor, what role do you think factors? You mentioned emotional bonding. If this had been handled more along the lines of what you're advocating, what role should factors like daily caregiving and veterinary care and the bonding have played in the court's decision here?
Well, yes, you just touched on two or three of the big ones. Who has spent most time with the animal? Who does the animal come to? Does the animal have a preference in the humans? Who has the financial capacity to take care of the animal? If you have a large dog, you don't want to give it to the person that's moved to New York City apartment. If the other person has the ability to have a yard and to have other things that would enhance the life of the companion animal.
Professor, one of the issues with this kind of ruling, obviously, is that it just rewards not the parent, the owner that is best served or best suited to care for the dog, but it's the one who is most financially able to do that, right? It's just a plain auction, and whoever puts up the highest amount gets the dog regardless. I mean, it seems like from, you know, the filings, they both are really, you know, they really love the dog and they have great relationships. But if this is a precedent, then in the future, it's like whoever can afford to win this auction gets the dog.
Yeah, no, that runs counter to all property concepts. Even if you forget about what we're talking about here, if you talk about the property concepts, then who bought the dog should be the dominant factor, not who has the most money at this point in time. You've taken away title and given it possibly to somebody who didn't previously own it because they didn't have enough money to bid. And one would think that between two spouses at the time of divorce, there's
on Legal Face-Off
money available to those people, and therefore somebody's going to be advantaged over the other.
So, Professor, do you think this is a one-off solution, one-off case, or do you think it may serve as a model for other courts to adopt in future pet custody disputes?
I think it's a one-off. I think most courts thinking about this would say, there's a lot of public policy saying, first of all, we should go to best interest of the animal, but there's also some real downsides to this idea of an auction as well. So I think she didn't want to deal with it. I think she just said, I've heard enough from you all, just put a bid on the table. I'll give it to whoever has the highest bid. That's relinquishment of judicial responsibility.
Last question. I know here in Chicago where we are, there is an alderman, actually in my neighborhood, the aldermen are the local city councilors, who is proposing that local ordinances preventing dogs and other animals from, you know, entering restaurants places where they serve food should be repealed and that a dog should be allowed. I want that. I'm looking at my dog right now. He's asleep with his friend Ray, who's here on a play date. You know, most states you're not allowed to bring dogs into restaurants. We understand the health implications there, perhaps. But do you see perhaps that as a trend? I hope it is. Yes. I don't think it's going to gain much traction here, but I hope so.
Well, in Europe, they've had dogs in restaurants for decades, and somehow they've survived and haven't caught massive diseases. I think it's a reaction to old health concerns and people that – obviously, a restaurant has the right to say if there's something going wrong, they should say, no dog, that dog shouldn't be here. But most of us know our dogs and know whether or not we can take them to a place and they won't be a public nuisance.
Professor David Favor, what kind of dog do you have? Do you have one dog?
We have three Great Pyrenees.
Oh, very nice. Names?
Molly, Mabel, and Axel.
I think Rich nice. Stepped away so he could grab Ziggy, perhaps.
I got to get Ziggy's appearance on the show.
You got to get... There we go.
There we go. Oh, look at that. Cool.
No one is. He looks like Tucker.
No one is, but he does look like Tucker.
Rich, how much...
He's Tucker.
Rich, how much to part ways with Ziggy? How much do I have to give you?
Maybe I'll give you this one. Hold on. Ray, say hi.
Oh, hi, wow.
This is buddy Ray, who's hanging out for the day.
This is a professional podcast, Professor. Thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You are listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Dina is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers & Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crane's Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and she frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. McDermott, Will & Emery is an integrated international law firm. McDermott has an uncompromising commitment to legal excellence, extraordinary client service, and a high-performance culture. It is committed to helping clients achieve stellar legal and business results today and well into the future. To contact Tina and to learn more about McDermott, Will & Emery, visit MWE.com.
Don't forget to listen, like, and subscribe to the Legal Face-Off podcast on WGNRadio.com. Steve Fretzen, Be That Lawyer. He's here with us, a top yes. lawyer business development coach. He's a columnist, podcast contributor, five-time best-selling author. We'll get to the books in a little bit. And a plane crash survivor. We may need to talk a little bit about that with the Greg Biffle news we heard today. He's from Highwood, Illinois, but Steve's here to tell us how to up our podcast game, I think.
Yeah, I would love to talk about that. I was on Bob Surratt years ago talking about the plane crash. That was a heck of an interview with you guys.
So, Steve, as Ryan mentioned, we've known you for a long time, both as a return guest on Legal Face-Off, and you and I were introduced by one of my former colleagues, now clients, probably about 15 years ago now. And obviously, you're a business development coach. You also generate a lot of thought leadership that is really terrific. For those of our listeners who may not have caught you on our podcasts previously where we've chatted with you, can you tell us a little bit more about what you do?
Yeah, so I spend my time every day, all day, working with attorneys around the globe, doing the one thing that they never learned. There's many things they didn't learn in law school, as you guys know, but the one thing that really lawyers need now more than ever is business development and personal branding. And I've spent the last 18 years as a non-lawyer focused on helping lawyers learn to plan and execute with sales-free processes to grow business without ever feeling icky about it, because I think that's kind of a known thing that lawyers really didn't get into go to law school and become lawyers to go out and sell legal services, but it's now become sort of important for them to understand the business side of things. And so I've really leaned into helping as many lawyers as I can every year to get accomplished in that space.
Steve, we're talking about podcasts as growth strategy. By the way, you and I have known each other for a long time too. We've worked together you know, you're great at what you do. You work in addition to the work you do with attorneys, you write prolifically for Above the Law, for Daily Law Bulletin, which is still something I read actually in a newspaper, believe it or not. I have a whole stack of them I got to catch up on over the holidays, but I love your articles. Talk to us about podcasting as a means of driving business. You know, you have made it. You're on the world's longest running legal podcast. Why are podcasts important as a business development tool, and how have you used it to grow your business?
All right, so I'm just going to cut to the chase. I've written books. I've been writing for publications. I've been speaking all over the place. I've done just about everything you could do to build business and help people. Nothing has come close to the power of having my own podcast. And people are out there saying, well, who needs, the world doesn't need another podcast. There's so few people that are not only producing great content, but also that are staying consistent with putting out week after week, in my case, twice a week, the content that's useful to their audience. And so I started around 6 years ago. I've produced, I think, 570 episodes. And the people I've met, like you, Rich, I think we met through the podcast originally, okay? And the relationships that get developed, the content that's created, the ability to repurpose that content for audio, for visual, for text. This book behind me, 101 Top Rainmaker Secrets, all from, you know, the podcast, just transcribed down into articles and into chapters, and you create a book. So there's just so many benefits that I never realized would come to play. And the other piece of it is, when you're your true authentic self and you're creating great content, people really feel that they get to know you as a human and as a professional in your space. And podcasting, more so than books and articles, has really allowed my voice to come out and help people directly. And they get to know, they're in the back seat of the car with me, you know, twice a week. So I get people coming to me that are like pre-sold and ready to go, because who else are they going to choose?
So Steve, I actually, to your point about the book, I was very honored to be included because we had done a podcast that was one of the many that you included in the book, and it's terrific. I have it. I've read it. It's really great. You make a really strong case, and you mention a bunch of things. You know, you just talked about them. You mentioned them in your recent Above the Law article about why there's a compelling business reason for lawyers to consider using podcasting as a growth strategy. For those lawyers who may be considering doing a podcast, what are some do's and don'ts that you think they should think about before getting started? And are there maybe certain types of lawyers or practices that may not be conducive to having a podcast?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I'll try to be brief with this. The don'ts are, don't do it yourself. You are not an expert at production. You're not an expert at marketing. You're not an expert at editing. Why are you doing your own podcast? The good news is there's more podcast editors and production teams now than have ever been. I would not be in podcasting in the place that I'm in without you, Tina, because after being on your podcast, I said, who does this for you? And how much time does it take? You're like, it takes no time at all. I turn it over to Turnkey Podcast, who I've used for the 6 years I've been doing it, and they're incredible. And there's other podcast companies out there that are doing not only the podcast, but they're doing social media for you. They're creating all the content. It's really a plug and play now more than ever. So the don'ts are, don't do it yourself. The do is, and don't do it if you're not going to be consistent, if you're not really committed to it. The do is, if you really feel like you have something to say, if you really feel that, you know, you want to meet new people in a non-salesy environment where you can have authentic conversations and build incredible content that you can then take and repurpose and stay consistent with. I don't know that there's anything better from a standpoint of like the ability to meet people and build content. And that content goes for AI and for Google and all the different places where people want to find you, and being a thought leader, I just can't talk highly enough about it.
Steve, while we don't want to encourage so many lawyers to start podcasts, I am interested in the idea of, you know, how you use it as a branding and marketing tool. Because, you know, people have asked me, we've been doing this show for almost 11 years when, you know, well, shout out Brian Watercott, who came from WGN, you know, and came to me with and pitched me this idea. We'll credit him. When he came to me, you know, my question was, well, what's my return on investment, right? As a business person, I want to know for the time and effort and expense I'm putting in, what my return is. And to this day, when people ask me, like, why do you do the podcast? Why are you so committed to it? Why do you do it so consistently? Do you get business out of it? I don't know. I've never gotten a client who said, oh, I heard your podcast and I'm hiring you. Given that, why is there a return on investment in doing this this thing we call podcasting?
Well, I think, again, it's an opportunity for you to think of it from not only a business development perspective, but also a marketing and branding perspective. So, Rich, I mean, you're the perfect case study for me. I met you on the podcast. I mentioned to you about my Rainmaker Roundtable. You're like, that sounds interesting. And then we did that for a few years, right? So I think that there's opportunities to meet people, to develop relationships that could be strategic and possibly even direct. And that's happened to me a number. I'll give you another example. I interviewed the CEO of lawyer.com, and she's like a day away from sending me a contract to being my new sponsor for my podcast. She loved the concept of it, had her on my podcast today, and Colleen was amazing. So I think that there's direct business that can be generated from it. Again, if you're meeting the right people, inviting the right people on, and develop a strong enough relationship before and during the podcast, and then again, what's the follow-up like? Then there's all the content you create that can be long form. You can break it up into clips for social media, YouTube. You can transcribe it into articles. Those articles are now being placed in Attorney at Work, a publication. My video clips are being put into Attorney at Work and Above the Law. So think about the branding that's happening, because you create great content, you break it up into pieces, and then you have ways of expanding it through relationships with publications. It's really incredible.
So Steve, we just putting your BD coach hat on for a second. We've talked a lot, both in the context of the show, as well as when I've appeared on your podcast, about how the legal industry is just becoming even more increasingly competitive. It's accelerating, particularly against the backdrop of a few things like AI, consolidation in the industry, and those sorts of things. Do you have any words of wisdom that you can share in the last couple of minutes here with our audience about how they can put their best foot forward from a business development standpoint, knowing that there's a lot of convergence happening in the industry, and which is making it tougher for lawyers to differentiate themselves and to land business?
Yeah, I mean, I'll give you two very direct answers. Number one is, you know, we're in the attention economy. So you're either playing ball or you're not. You're sitting on the sidelines with no LinkedIn profile, no engagement, no content, and you're just God's best given, you know, best kept secret, right? No one knows about you except your clients. They think you're amazing. You know you're amazing, but no one else knows you. So it's like, I'm a top brain surgeon. I could save lives every day, but nobody's coming to me for brain surgery. Like, that's not a great place to be. The other thing is, you know, we keep hearing, you know, lawyers don't learn about business development in law school. It's not taught. So I'm really trying to be an advocate for the industry and for the lawyers to say, you need to step up and think about being a student of the game. There are books, articles, podcasts, videos, coaches, mentors, advisors. You need to start playing the game and understanding that being a great lawyer is really table stakes. It's what are you doing above and beyond that for client relationships? What are you doing above and beyond that to generate revenue for your firm and for yourself? How are you becoming that lawyer? That Be That Lawyer theme, right, is all about how are you adding value to others in the world? And you can't do that just being a billable, you know, 2,000 billable hours a year. That's great. You're going to make good dough, but that's not a good long-term strategy for most attorneys.
Steve, last question. What's the biggest misconception that you see from lawyers that you take on about marketing? What's the biggest thing that they think works that maybe they're wrong about?
It's really the attitude of, you know, I don't want to be a marketer. I don't want to be in sales. This is not what I signed up for, and I'm not going to play that game. And what they're not realizing is that, like I said before, you're either in the game or you're out of the game. But more importantly is, you know, it's a competitive environment. Tina said so a few minutes ago. And so we have to start recognizing that the game has changed. The rules have changed. It's the business of law. And so we need to understand that we're not going to be leveraged properly today and in the future. I mean, you've got competition, you've got AI, you've got all these things, the billable hours at risk now, which we thought it would never happen, but it's coming around. And how are you preparing for that? So I think lawyers really need to get their mind straight about what's going on in the future and how they're going to be valuable to themselves and their families and the firm if they're not like taking the other side of the law seriously.
My big takeaway is if Steve, Tina, and Rich can do it, anyone can do it. Is that, would that be fair to say? All right, so I looked up Be That Lawyer, 101 Top Rainmakers Secrets to Growing a Successful Law Practice. If you order it today, you could have it under the tree Tuesday, December 23rd on Amazon. So that's, I'm guessing, what you would recommend.
Thanks, Ryan. And thanks for having me, guys. I really appreciate this. And I'm just so thrilled to be back.
Welcome back to Legal Faceoff on WGN, and it's time for the Legal Grab Bag. Greg Hamblin is Senior Vice President, Chief Claims Officer at Berkley Industrial Comp. He's also host of Adjusted, a claims podcast. We have like a podcast crossover, like kind of like when the Harlem Globetrotters were on Scooby-Doo. Also, I saw in the bio an IU next to your name, so I believe your eyes will be glued to the TV this college football post game. Am I correct?
I am living a fever dream. I have to keep pinching myself and saying, is this real? Do we win the Heisman? Are we number one seed? But my daughter's at Bama, so it's going to be an interesting ride.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, they could end up playing Bama, so that would be very interesting. And he's got a very festive sweater that maybe we'll dive into a little bit later. All right, Ryan Douglas is Vice President of Property and Casualty at USI Insurance Service. And the next person I'm going to invite to one of our Ryan parties. Ryan, have you been to a Ryan party before?
That's where I live, yeah. I mean, that's part and parcel.
You go to the Ryan parties? It's pretty cool. There was a big one in Manhattan. It's all Ryans who are there. So you are formally invited. Maybe I'll see you at the next one. All right. Let's get to this first topic here. Fresh off his address to the nation last night, President Trump says he plans to sue the BBC over another speech he made. This was one that he made on January 6th of 2021. He wants more than $5 billion, Rich. Billion.
Yeah, I mean, he said he would sue. He's filed suit on Monday against the British Broadcasting Corporation, this time asking for $5 billion, like you mentioned. We know that he has successfully gotten money out of other media outlets for similar kind of claims before. Tina, ABC, George Stephanopoulos' show, and also CBS from 60 Minutes. He has also had some lawsuits knocked out. A recent suit against CNN demanding damages over the network's use of the term big lie was tossed by a federal appeals court. But this is what Trump does, right? I mean, he brings these lawsuits, he extracts money from these corporations. Many allege that, some of the media deals that have gone on have, had his fingerprints on them. We know that most, big events Trump is involved in, but, he's got to prove that they were intentionally acting this way, that they intentionally splice these two separate clips together. And also, he's got to overcome a jurisdictional issue, right? We're a legal podcast, and he filed this in Miami, where he alleges the at least part of the broadcast was made, and that also his attorneys say that he's going to overcome jurisdiction against this British company because some of the BBC footage was at Mar-a-Lago, which is of course in Florida. So just another day in Trump world. I imagine that the BBC would settle. They said they're going to fight this in court, right? They said they apologize. Interestingly, they said they apologize for it, but that they did not defame him, that they did nothing wrong, and they look forward to their day in court. So who knows?
Yeah, Rich, I'd say that my guess is, based on what we've seen so far, that the BBC, at least out of the gate, is going to fight this. And then depending on how certain things play out, they may end up settling, which is where the money will come from. But I agree. I mean, the whole jurisdiction issue is a big one. Also, the splicing together doesn't necessarily make it, deceitful or in any way. I mean, like that's their main argument. And I actually think there's merit to it, that the splicing was not really material. So so we'll see what happens here. But I do think the BBC is going to fight it, at least initially.
Yeah, I mean, Greg, as recently as this week, Trump continues to claim that he won the election. On the one hand, he's a lame duck president. He's got record disapproval ratings. You would think that he would be wanting to look forward as he tried to do last night in this, you know, in this delivery. I don't know that he was successful, but instead he continues to sort of labor on about this election that took place many years ago.
Yeah, I don't see that ending anytime soon. He seems hyper-focused on winning at all costs on his terms. So I think that we're going to continue to see the same behaviors over the next several years with more lawsuits to follow.
Ryan, do you think it's okay that elected officials like the president can go after these private companies and threaten to use the FCC and revoke their licenses? Do you think that's okay? Or do you think that the president should, or elected officials should, be beyond that and respect the First Amendment rights of the press?
Yeah, I mean, it's a slippery slope. You know, when you have the pulse on the FCC and, you know, I think more than anything is, you know, this shouldn't be about trying to win or lose. This should be about, you know, what's right by and for the people. The concern that I have if I'm sitting in the BBC's, you know, camp is the fact that we have come out and, you know, apologized on behalf of the BBC, you know, speaking to the attorneys in the crowd by making that sort of gesture. You know, does that open themselves up and show that, you know, that they do find some culpability by making an apology as such?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, I think, you know, if you're in front of a jury, of course, the jury might consider that. But from a legal perspective, you know, they've got the burden. Trump has the burden to prove that this was actionable defamation. And I think the fact that they apologize doesn't change that. But, you know, a jury could look at that differently, of course.
Yeah, jury, you're certainly right. And Tina, you know, you kind of mentioned, you know, the fact that jurisdiction is another issue. You know, as I understand it, you know, the entire document or the documentary was produced and delivered overseas. This is probably in Britain, not necessarily documented here, and it was only through a couple degrees of separation that you know, local U.S. citizens were able to access by dipping in and using a VPN. You know, so the jurisdictional issue, whether it's Miami or New York or D.C., it maybe doesn't matter if the intent has always been to keep it in local, you know, Britain or wherever else the BBC was broadcasting.
All right, let's why don't we move on to the Nick Reiner case? We touched on it a little earlier, Tina, as Nick faces charges. It's not clear yet if he's competent to stand trial.
Yeah, Ryan. So we're just horrified by the story that started unfolding Sunday night, the gruesome murders of actor and director Rob Reiner and his wife, Michelle, seemingly at the hands of their own son, Nick, who appeared briefly in court yesterday morning, which was the day after he was charged with two counts of first degree murder. The LA County District Attorney is also pursuing a murder conviction with special circumstances, which is a designation that could make him eligible for the death penalty or life in prison without parole. The prosecutors in the case have a lot of experience with complex homicides and include one of the prosecutors who actually most recently blocked the resentencing efforts for the Menendez brothers. He had been scheduled to appear for an arraignment and was expected to enter a plea, but his lawyer, who is an esteemed lawyer, Alan Jackson, told the court that it was too early for a plea, and then the decision was made and an agreement was reached to delay the arraignment to January 7. He also said that, as you alluded to, Ryan, you know, there are questions about his fitness for trial and that there are other complex issues involved in the case. And he's asking people to reserve judgment until those issues continue to unfold. It was the Reiner's daughter, Romy, who found her parents murdered in their home. After receiving a call from a massage therapist who had gone to the home and had her ringing of the doorbell unanswered. Nick has had a very public battle with addiction. His parents have been extraordinarily supportive of him over the years. He worked on a film called Being Charlie with his father, which was loosely inspired by his early life. We continue to hear details about what happened the night before, including going, the family had gone to the Conan O'Brien holiday party where Rob Reiner had gotten into a very heated argument with Nick, and where people at the party, Rich, were saying that he was acting really inappropriately and was freaking everybody out. This is just an extraordinarily sad case, and I'm sure we're going to be hearing a lot about it in the weeks to come.
Yeah, we'll obviously be covering this important legal story. You know, we just talked about it a few minutes ago as to whether the Slayer statue will prevent him from being able to access any of the estate. Alan Jackson, you know, came aboard this week, and he, of course, as you mentioned, has represented many. He prosecuted, you know, many as a prosecutor. I know that he worked on the Phil Spector prosecution. He's also represented Kevin Spacey and Karen Reed, you know, in Boston, the retrial. We cover that extensively. So, you know, high profile lawyer, you know, another murder in Brentwood. That part's interesting as well. And, you know, it's obviously a tragedy to the family. I was just literally watching the Spinal Tap sequel. Spinal Tap's one of my top five movies of all time. Of course, Rob Reiner directed it. It was his first film ever, and he appears in the sequel. A lot of interesting legal stories. You know, a part of this, Ryan, Alan Jackson, the lawyer I mentioned, he said that there's lots of complex issues involved. I expect, as Tina mentioned, that he's probably going to argue diminished capacity as a defense. We don't know that yet. There might be some other factors involved. He'll probably allege that, you know, he was not able to form the requisite mens rea because of his, you know, addiction to drugs. Who knows? We'll see. But yeah, interesting case. Anyone else have thoughts on it, Greg?
Just sad all the way around. You know, there's two people who aren't here now, and now there's going to be a son that's going to have to, regardless of the outcomes, the legal outcomes, his life is never going to be the same. And I think that's the thing that we have to keep in mind, whether he ends up going to jail or he ends up in some other capacity. This is one of those sad, sad days that everybody lost.
All right, let's move along to I guess we'll stay in Southern California. Actress and model Riley Keough claims she donated her eggs to John Travolta and the late Kelly Preston so the couple could have their son Benjamin. Rich, she's the daughter of Lisa Marie Presley, so there's actually some Elvis DNA involved in this.
Yeah, I'm trying to like do the cross chart between Barbarino and Elvis.
Yeah, right.
Travolta and Elvis. So yeah, it's kind of a weird lawsuit. Riley Keough, as you mentioned, is the granddaughter of Elvis. Riley Keough's mom was Lisa Marie Presley, who was the daughter of Priscilla Presley, who was married to the King. And, you know, John Travolta had, what, three kids? And the youngest one, the allegation goes, according to this complaint, is that he couldn't have kids anymore with Kelly Preston, who died, I think, in 2020. His wife was also an actress. And that they got their son, they had their son from these eggs donated by Riley Keough. And I guess this is brought by Priscilla Presley, who also is deceased, former business associates, Tina. Ultimately about money, I guess. I guess they're looking to recover from Travolta for these eggs, right? That would be the allegation.
I mean, I think that that's what's hinted at. I think the most objectionable part of this, I think, was in the process of all of this, there was conversation about how originally they were thinking about going to Lisa Marie for the eggs, but because, and they ended up saying because of her addiction issues that right. He wanted to go to her daughter instead. And so, you know, this is already a very contentious litigation involving the family, but I think this, first of all, has not been substantiated, this claim at all. I think that Priscilla has flatly denied that it's true, but who knows? But I think it's just the whole conversation around Lisa Marie. And, you know, that they would have gone to her, but for the fact that she had addiction issues, they didn't want her eggs. And it's just making this whole issue and this whole litigation continue to spiral.
Yeah. And, you know, we've covered, Ryan, like, when Lisa Marie died in January of 2023, there's been a lot of lawsuits involving, you know, control of the estate involving Riley Keough or her daughter. I mean, obviously, it's one of the most, you know, prized pieces of IP in the world, right? I mean, you know, as the keeper of the Elvis estate, that is worth in the billions. Elvis continues to be one of the big draws, even though he's been dead for so many years. So you understand, like we always cover in these celebrity cases, how there's people looking or trying to get some money, but kind of a bizarre one. But I guess if you're going to get the eggs of someone, why not link it to one of the greatest performers of all time, right?
Well, certainly, I was going to say the Graceland story from 2024, where there was discussion about them trying to take Graceland away.
Yeah.
Doesn't sound like the family has managed their finances well over the last several decades, which has put them in a place where they're really looking for solutions. So I don't know what the merits of this are, but there's a clear need for money in the family due to spending past what was in the estate.
Well, and this is just another dip into that. I'm sure these attorneys aren't working for free in hopes of finding that maybe there was coercion to get Riley to, you know, give up her eggs. You know, was it John Travolta and or that family pushing and coercing, or, you know, is this back on Priscilla for you know, having her, you know, requiring or suggesting her daughter be the bearer of the eggs.
Elvis lives on, right? Yeah. We all know that. All right. An attorney and a law firm for the Chicago Housing Authority has been sanctioned for using ChatGPT in a court case. And Tina, as we've learned, you still got to check your work, even if you use ChatGPT.
Brian, we've talked about this. It seems like every show we do something relating to ChatGPT and AI. In this case, the Chicago Housing Authority was involved in a lawsuit involving the poisoning of two children by lead paint. And they hired the law firm Goldberg Sagala. And there was a lawyer who worked there until recently. And it was over the summer that this lawyer used ChatGPT in connection with some filings with the court. She did not check her work. And as a result, there were some serious errors. And apparently this is not the first time that this lawyer has used AI improperly and in a way that has resulted in multiple case citations that were incorrectly generated through hallucinations. Interestingly, this lawyer has not actually been penalized for the error, nor has the CHA. It's her former law firm, Goldberg Sagala, as well as the lawyer who signed off on the motion that had cited the fake court case. They were both sanctioned for a total of $60,000. In the order, the judge referenced that the firm's conduct was a serious failure and said that the focus of the decision is not so much the fact that artificial intelligence was misused. What the judge found particularly troubling was the submission of the false authority and the factual arguments to the court and the misrepresentation, at least in the judge's mind, that the firm had made about the extent of the conduct and the failure to take what the judge viewed as prompt responsibility for the errors once the errors were discovered. So, Rich, this is just another example. And as I mentioned earlier, there seems to be every week we seem to see some cases involving, you know, it's not always necessarily court filings. It's just cases, matters where there's just improper, unchecked use of AI resulting in hallucinations or just failure to provide work product that doesn't result in things like malpractice.
Hey, Chat, what do you think about the cases or the case involving the Chicago Housing Authority lawyers who got sanctioned by the Cook County Court?
Hey there. So that case is definitely an interesting one. Basically, the situation involves a lawyer working for
Don't give me the summary. Tell me your opinion, damn it.
Well, honestly, my take is that it's one of those situations where the court's just reminding everyone that you can't cut corners or play too fast and loose, even if you're dealing with a big public agency. It's a bit of a nudge that professionalism and adherence to the rules matter.
Hey, thank you, Captain Obvious. We'll see you later.
I
Wow, what an insight from ChatGPT.
They admitted that they're not accurate.
Exactly. We have that on recording. We ought to send this into the judge.
Don't trust us, they say.
Yeah.
Tell you what, these types of things are going to continue to happen. And I think as we look at the industry, there's a lot of concern about jobs that are going to be removed. But the one thing that's not going to change is there needs to be somebody to blame. And so there will have to be a human in the loop, because no one's going to accept ChatGPT being the person to blame. It's going to be the person who didn't review it. And the example I give my team all the time, I just very quickly was doing a continuing education for another vendor as a friend, and asked if I could post LinkedIn their continuing ed. And so I did, and they didn't have a post. So I just took the email, threw it through ChatGPT, glanced it over, posted it. And the guy's name is Chris Rocks, which is pretty awesome. But his email was changed by a hallucination to chris.stones@such-and-such company. And I'm not sure. Not sure how they decided, how ChatGPT or what we use Copilot decided to change his email from rocks to stones. But these are the simple things that could get you in a lot of trouble if it was something more important than a LinkedIn post.
Greg, did you ask any AI entity whether you should wear that sweater that you're – show everyone that we realize you got it in a sweater exchange. But if only you asked someone, hey, AI, should I wear the sweater?
I think it would say no. I think it would say no, but I'm here for it. So Ryan, bring all holiday cheer, right?
It's a great sweater. Ryan, AI is going to replace a lot of us. We in the legal field are very aware of its rise, and in some circumstances like this, the dangers. What about in the insurance world that you're in?
Yeah, I mean, Greg already mentioned, the use that we have. He mentioned one of the leaders, Copilot. We're getting to a point where we're doing our policy checking that way. Customer service can be very much so automated in the AI format. The question still remains, how prolific will it become? In our world, aggregation of data and the most efficient means by aggregating data is important. So historically, we've used pretty archaic process for managing and understanding risk, and the utilization of AI technology is certainly something on the horizon. Most insurance carriers and brokers are implementing policies and procedures around utilization. What we're doing, though, is we are kind of masking our industry. So we only look inside our own walls and our own doors for data, not necessarily external. As soon as you go external, that's where you can get these misrepresentations, which is a segue back into this story of misrepresenting a case. I like the term hallucination because that's essentially what it's done. I think this also goes back, and there was kind of the point in question of, well, who's negligent and who's liable? Fortunately for this attorney, the corporate veil is the one entity that's protecting them. So it's the organization, whether or not their E&O is picking up some cover, but they certainly, are pointing the finger back at the law firm, not so much the individual.
All right, let's move along to humans doing human things. A naked man was arrested at a Planet Fitness. He told police he thought the gym was a judgment-free zone. Who do you think threw this story in the bag for us? ChatGPT, who do you think threw this one in out of this panel?
So we don't have the video, right? But this guy in Florida, what a shocker this happened in Florida. He was running naked through this Planet Fitness. And the cops said that as he climbed into the ceiling, is that right? That he tried to start a fire in the gym. They found him hiding inside a tanning bed. But they have, like, I don't know if you've been to Planet Fitness, but they have this thing on the wall that says no lung cans. They got a lung can alarm. I don't know if this could qualify. How much was he on that he was climbing in the tanning bed on the ceiling? But I'll tell you, it leads me to another part of the story, Tina, which is like, men are too comfortable being naked in gyms. I'll give you an example. I go to a gym. I go to a gym. You know, my club here in the city. I go to, and I go to the locker room, and man, if there aren't like 80-year-olds who are super comfortable just walking around naked nonstop, it's like you realize you're not in your home, right? This is like, even though it's a locker, it's a public place. And I look over and I see like there are mounds of towels. There are hundreds of available towels to cover up these old men's, you know, nether regions. But yet they're just standing there, walking around, proud to be nude. So my lesson here is, hey, old man, put on a friggin' towel in the gym.
This might be a new like workout routine that we're talking about here. Run around naked and jump through the ceiling and light a fire. I'm sure that burns some calories.
This guy just sounds, I mean, he's just like getting attention, right? I mean, this is all about getting attention. The whole notion that being in a judgment-free zone means that you can run around naked is just preposterous to me.
Yeah, his defense was perfect, Ryan. It's a judgment-free zone. Don't judge me. I like to work out and start fires naked. Come on. Is that really, if someone mentioned that was wrong, that just seems like nitpicking. Is that wrong?
All right, let's talk about Lady Gaga. She won a victory in a lawsuit that was filed against her by a surf brand. Tina, you threw this one in the bag for us.
Yeah, we're going to call this the Gaga Saga. So the Gaga Saga started a few months ago in March when she released her seventh album, Mayhem. Obviously, in the true Gaga fashion, it made a number one debut on the album chart. Mayhem, as a word, also happens to be the longstanding brand of a surfboard manufacturer, a brand that's actually been around for almost 40 years. And the company's name is Lost. And in true Ryan fashion, I'm going to say it was not lost on them that Lady Gaga named her album Mayhem and was actually starting to produce merchandise, including clothing and bandanas that had the word Mayhem on them. There are also some arguable similarities between the two logos as well. But it was on this basis that Lost sent a cease and desist letter to Lady Gaga claiming a likelihood of confusion and trademark infringement. Lady Gaga did not back down once she got that demand letter. And as a result, Lost sued her and actually sought a preliminary injunction because the case was pending and she was touring where she was selling a ton of this merchandise and making a lot of money. So on Monday, the judge had denied the motion for preliminary injunction, saying that at the end of the day, the judge doesn't really see that there's a likelihood of confusion here and that there's an element of artistic relevance with respect to using the name of the album and the logo on her tour merchandise, and that Lost did not provide evidence that Lady Gaga was trying to mislead the customers and people who bought the merchandise into thinking that they were buying gear associated with Lost. And so, Rich, while this is not the end of the road for the case, this is a very significant win for Lady Gaga. And while Lost said that they didn't expect to win the preliminary injunction motion, oftentimes, these sorts of decisions are pretty important in terms of how the case moves forward. And I mean, I can understand why they filed the lawsuit, but at the end of the day, I'm not seeing the confusion here at all.
It's a money grab. Look, it's a win for Lady Gaga. It's also a win for the world. You know why? Because we're running out of damn words. Like Mayhem. Mayhem should be able to be used for more than one. Why did they sue the Allstate guy? That's what everyone thinks of for Mayhem. That guy's next in line, the Allstate Mayhem guy. But like, there's only so many words around. Like, I don't know. Anthrax is both a band and a poison. If I listen to Anthrax, is the poison manufacturer, is there such a thing going to come after Anthrax? Or I don't know, like A Flock of Seagulls, right? Great 80s band. Is there going to be a flock of actual seagulls who are suing the band that came out with Too Shy, I think it was. I mean, you can go on and on.
If they get the right attorney, they can make the lawsuit.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, for God's sake, Sugar Ray. Sugar Ray's a band from the 90s. You know, nice band. I don't confuse Sugar Ray with Sugar Ray Leonard or Sugar Ray Robinson. Just stop it. Just stop it, Ryan Douglas.
I am a proud supporter of Lost Surf and had a Mayhem sweatshirt back in the day. So I take some kind of finger pointing back at Lady Gaga. Shame on her. Make the emblem look different. No, I'm only kidding. Here's what they get around. You just put Mayhem album. Just put the album right underneath it, and you know she's gonna be fine.
I don't know about that. I'm a trademark lawyer, but I understand Tito, where you're coming from.
All right. This is the last legal face-off before Christmas and the New Year. We're in the middle of Hanukkah. So let's close out with Tina Martini and the 12 law stories of Christmas past.
We cut it to a more.
Yeah, we cut it to six.
We prioritized. Baker's dozen. There we go.
We had an embarrassment of riches when it came to these stories. So
speaking of embarrassment of riches.
Yeah. As our listeners know, we like to bring in the holidays talking about fun cases. And while there are so many to choose from, particularly for Christmas and Hanukkah, we do have a few that we focused on and shared with our guests and would love to hear from them about which ones are their favorite. We have lawsuits involving everything from Christmas songs that don't stop to infringing sweater designs. Greg, I'm worried about your sweater, to horrible lawn and house decorations and everything in between. So my personal favorite was the one about Santa Claus that was cited not for a sleigh traffic violation, but when Santa Claus was pulled over, he presented a fake ID following a minor collision. He showed an Ohio identification card to the police officer who saw that it was in the name of Santa Claus. But in court, Santa was actually able to produce 8 documents in support of his argument that his identification card was legitimate. And at the end of the day, the court granted Santa's motion. He was seen as a real person since at least as early as 1982, Rich. So you cannot make this stuff up.
This is my favorite of those stories, partly due to the fact that there is truly a North Pole, North Pole, Alaska, right outside of Fairbanks, and had the pleasure of seeing reindeer there, meeting a Santa Claus. And I guess if you're able to get a legal name change to jolly old Saint Nick and Santa Claus, good on the judge for throwing it out. Don't rain on Santa's parade.
I love the ones, rightfully so, where people are suing to stop the damn incessant songs, right? I mean, there's like inmates who are suing. There's neighbors who are suing. One guy was a lawyer and he sued his neighbor for jingle bells. I agree. I mean, just stop with the nonstop freaking jingle bells. I've heard enough. It starts at Halloween now, right? I mean, you hear the songs at Halloween. It used to be Thanksgiving. Now it's Halloween. You start to hear the various songs and that just get in your head. So I'm all for it.
Have you guys gone by any of the light shows where you can actually tune in the radio and listen to the songs? You don't.
Oh yeah.
It's not actually amplified out. You can hear it inside of your car.
All right. Well, let's end off, of course, with Christmas or the holiday season. We like to ask our guests, Greg and Ryan, a surprise question that you weren't prepared for. Get to know a little bit more about you as we send you off into the holiday season. So I know we've probably done 10 Christmas episodes, and we've probably covered these topics. So how about your least favorite part of Christmas? We'll be Scrooge. Everyone can say their favorite part, but what part about Christmas, like listening to Jingle Bells, can you put in the rear view forever? Ryan Burrow.
All right, I'm going to say as a manager here at the old radio station, I would say 2 weeks after Christmas – half of these people are going to call off sick because they're going to go, they're going to hug their aunts, they're going to hug their cousins, they're going to cough all over each other. And then by like the first week of January, all these people are sick. So that's my least favorite part.
That's a good one. Tina Martini, least favorite part of Christmas or the holiday season in general?
Eggnog.
Yeah.
The good one. Greg, do you like your eggnog?
No, I'm not an eggnog guy. I'll tell you what, though. My personal hell is my wife, when we were dating, she said she wanted to have 10 children. And I said 3 to 5. and we ended up at 6. Do you know how many presents that is to wrap? That's like a personal hell of just, you have to like put all the piles out. I lose days. Days of my life have been spent wrapping these stupid things. And I will say, can't we just get gift bags and reuse them every year? And my wife's like, that's not how my family did it. So funny enough, she's never the one wrapping. So I will say my least favorite part of the year is wrapping Christmas presents.
There you go. That's a good one, Ryan.
I'm going to go right on the heels of Greg and talk about what happens right after that. I'm the proverbial garbage gatherer and end up filling my recycle bin. Inevitably, Christmas and the holidays fall on or the day after garbage collection. So now I've got my recycle and garbage sitting for 2 straight weeks, full as can be, and can't put the really garbage in it anymore. So, that's my job.
That's where you swing by the church and find an empty dumpster and see if you can drop up. Hope they don't have cameras.
Yeah. Lisa, you live in a state that actually has a town called Santa Claus, home of a former Bear awful quarterback, Jay Cutler. What is your least favorite tradition of the holidays?
House guests that don't leave.
It's a good one. Kick them the hell out.
Notice she hasn't invited any of us over.
Yeah.
You're more than welcome as long as you leave in a time frame.
Yeah. Mine is like the nonstop having to say the words happy holidays in your emails. And like, oh, if I don't say happy holidays, am I committing some sin? Is there some rule that I have to end off every email from Halloween until friggin' Easter with happy holidays? And does anyone really care? Like, do they really think that I'm wishing them happy holidays? Or is it just something we all have to contractually say when we're writing these damn emails? Can we go away with a happy holidays?
Bah, humbug.
Let's just stipulate that we all wish each other happy holidays. And let me write a quicker email and get the hell out of my life.
The boroughs shook the tradition of the Christmas card this year. Every year around this time when we're getting them, we're like, oh, do we really want to do it? Do we really want to? And then we end up going to Walgreens and doing it anyways. But this year, my wife's like, nah, we're not going to do it. So looks like that tradition is dead, which will make many family members sad, I suppose. But I don't know.
If they want to hear how you're doing, they can always call you.
Exactly. Exactly. Or come see me, right? All right. Let's put a wrap on this. A nice little bow. Thanks to Ryan Douglas and Greg Hamblin for joining us on Legal Face Off. Also, we had Gloria Allred on with Allred Morocco and Goldberg, Sean Weisbart of Blank Rome, Professor David Favor of Michigan State University, and podcaster, author, and development coach Steve Fretzen. Also, thanks to Ben Anderson and Lisa Stigl for another great year of Legal Face Off. It's in the books. Thanks again for joining us. We'll see you in 2026.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Linkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question? Just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget.